This show is created for adult audiences only. Our show notes include content warnings and other helpful information. We strongly recommend taking a moment to assess the situation before continuing. Let's begin.
Episode 36. The Yuba County 5. It is often said to take the path less traveled. However, that is not always the best advice. For some, it is best to stick to the path that is known, frequently traveled, and not full of surprises. Unfortunately, this was not the case for the five California men that ventured off into the wilderness, only to never be seen again. Much like the infamous Dyatlov Pass incident before it, this story remains a mystery to this day. No one quite knows what went through the minds of the men on that dreadful night in February of 1978. Join us, campers, as we attempt to reconstruct the story of the Yuba County 5. It was a chilly day in February of 1978, colder than the citizens of Yuba City would have anticipated. Jack Madruga sat in his 1969 Mercury Montego, along with two of his friends, Jackie Hewitt in the passenger seat, and William Sterling in the back seat. They sat waiting for their friend Theodore Weir, so they could go pick up the remaining member of the group, Gary Mathias. Weir quickly rushed out the front door. He didn't have time to grab his coat, despite the cold evening air. He was too excited and figured he wouldn't need it anyway. He packed into the back seat next to Sterling as they drove to pick up Mathias. Gary Mathias sat anxiously waiting for his friends to pick him up. His patience was wearing thin as he anticipated the big game later that evening. He sat staring out the window, waiting for them to show up as he finished his dinner. The last few days, he and his group of friends had been planning a trip to drive to Chico to watch a basketball game at the California State University. Despite the impending weather and snowfall that day, their plans were still on. He watched as the headlights came up the road, and he spotted the familiar Mercury Montego. Before they could honk to let him know they were there, Mathias met them in the driveway. He, too, did not choose to wear his coat that day. He then packed into the back of the Montego as the five set out on a two-hour journey towards Chico, California. The car was full of excitement as they conversed and shared in their love for basketball. They had all been part of a local basketball team called the Gateway Gators and were supposed to play a game the next day, on February 25th, which could qualify them for the upcoming Paralympics. If they won the game, they would get to go to Los Angeles. Each of the five men shared some form of a disability or suffered from mental health issues. The men attended the Yuba City Gateway Program, which was a vocational rehabilitation center where they learned different trades while getting to play on the center's basketball team Theodore Weir, referred to as Ted by his friends, was the oldest of the group. Despite being the oldest, he had the mind and brain capacity of a child. He was a very friendly person and loved by many. He had recently been forced to quit his job due to being unable to handle the high-pressure workload. Jack Hewitt was the shortest of the group, standing a mere 5 feet and 9 inches tall. His head tended to droop slightly, and he had a hard time responding in social situations. However, when he was comfortable, he was a very cheerful man and made friends wherever he went. He was particularly fond of Ted Weir. They were often inseparable and went everywhere together. Jack Madruga had graduated high school and immediately enlisted in the Army, where he served in Vietnam, but was discharged after a medical evaluation. Despite never being actually diagnosed as disabled, he was often referred to or considered slow by those that knew him. He was the only one competent enough to obtain a driver's license. He loved driving and cherished his Mercury Montego as much as his love for basketball. Gary Mathias had also enlisted in the Army and had been stationed in West Germany. However, following a mental breakdown in 1973, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and was honorably discharged. This resulted in him taking medication for the last 5 years. His condition had improved significantly, and he was able to keep a job working for his father's landscaping business. The last of the group, Bill Sterling, was very similar to Ted. He too had the mind of a child and rarely left the house other than for church, basketball, or to spend time at a local hospital where he would read Bible verses to patients. This was something he loved to do as he cared deeply for others. As they continued on their journey towards Chico, the five men sat laughing and sharing their thoughts on the upcoming game they were to play the next day. However, sadly, they would never make it home to play. For that night was the last night anyone would ever see them alive again. As it was getting late that night and the men still hadn't arrived home, their families became very worried and contacted the local authorities to see if there was any word on them or if anyone had seen them. It was out of the ordinary for any of them to not return home, as none of them ever spent a night away. The police then issued a missing persons report on the men. It wasn't long before reports started coming in. Several of the witnesses stated that they had seen them attending the basketball game. Others stated that they had seen the Mercury Montego leaving the parking lot after the game. It was also reported by a cashier at a local convenience store that he had seen the men come in to purchase an assortment of drinks and snacks. However, they were only there briefly, and that was the last time that they were seen. A search party was then formed to try and locate the missing men, headed by Lieutenant Lance Ayers. Ayers had known them personally for many years. He had even attended high school with Ted Weir. Therefore, he felt a personal connection to the case. They searched the area and were left with no trace of the men. The search was then extended into the surrounding areas near Feather River Mountain Range. And after some time, Madruga's Mercury Montego had been found along the road in the Plumas National Forest, roughly 70 miles from Chico, on the 28th of February, 4 days after the men had went missing. The area had been covered in snow, almost masking and burying the vehicle. Surprisingly, it had been left intentionally parked, as if the men had planned to return to it. The keys were missing from the ignition, but the officers were able to hotwire the car to drive it back to Yuba City. It was also discovered that there was plenty of gas left for the men to make it back home. This struck the officers as odd. What would cause them to leave the car parked along the road when they could have just as easily finished their journey back to their hometown? They then checked to see if the car could have gotten stuck in the snow, but it was determined this was not the case. The search party continued to survey the area, but were stopped due to another snowstorm later in the night. As a result, the search was delayed till the spring, when the weather was better. This didn't stop Lieutenant Ayers. As the days progressed, he became even more determined than the last. He had to find the missing men, and nothing was going to stop him. He worked with the families to work every angle that they could. They even offered rewards for any information one could provide on their whereabouts. The phone calls then poured in from all over. Each claimed to see the men in different locations, from Ontario, Canada, to claims of them even being spotted in Florida. With each call, Ayers became more and more frustrated and was starting to lose hope. Till one day in June. On June 4th, Lieutenant Ayers received a call from a group of motorcyclists at the U.S. Forestry Services camp. They had discovered a body that had been wrapped in a set of blankets and had been there for some time, as decomposition had set in extensively. The body was identified to be that of Ted Weir, and after further examination, initial reports showed that Weir had lost more than 80 pounds. Only weighing 200 pounds when alive, it was determined that he may have starved to death. Further examination led to questions that could not be answered. Weir's shoes were missing, and frostbite had eaten away at his exposed feet. They also determined the length of his unkept beard suggested that he had survived for at least 8 weeks, but had never left the bed. Additionally, several army rations littered the floor, which had suggested that he had eaten at some point. The examiners also found an unlocked cabinet in the room that contained dehydrated food sitting untouched. It was said that there was enough food that could feed a small group for an entire year. Lieutenant Ayers investigated the scene and was surprised to find that no one had attempted to build a fire. He even found boxes of matches and plenty of papers and magazines to use for fuel. After further surveying the scene, he found a full propane tank behind the trailer, but it had never been turned on. The following day after discovering the body of Weir, the Plumas County Police found the body of Jack Madruga, roughly 11 miles from the trailer, near the road leading back to the car. It was determined he died along the way and most likely had been victim to hungry animals that inhabit the area. His body had been dragged almost 10 feet to a nearby stream. Most of the flesh on his right arm had been chewed off, his hand still clutching his watch, and his eyes and two fingers were missing. On the other side of the road, in a dense wooded area, police also found several bones scattered throughout. Further analysis proved the bones belonged to Bill Sterling. It was determined his body had also been consumed by forest animals and his remains were spread throughout a 50-square-foot area. News spread throughout Yuba City like wildfire. As devastating and tragic the story was, Jack Hewitt Sr. joined the search party, despite Lieutenant Ayer's suggestion to stay out of it. Shortly after joining the search, he located the backbone and the same pair of Levi jeans and shoes his son had been wearing the night that they had disappeared. The next day, Jack's skull was found, and the family dentist confirmed his identity by using his dental records. By this time, they had found 4 out of 5 of the men's remains. However, Gary Mathias had not been found. It had now been 4 months since the group's disappearance. Mathias' shoes had been discovered inside the trailer, suggesting he had swapped his for Weir's, which had been made of leather, and then left the trailer. To this day, Gary Mathias nor his body has ever been seen again or found. It was speculated that the men had been driving on the road, but had become lost. As the snowfall became more harsh, the men abandoned the vehicle and tried heading south on foot in the direction of home. By suggesting this, the men would have had to walk through harsh, rocky terrain and wilderness, roughly 20 miles, before reaching the service trailer. Once inside, they may have tried to locate food and something to start a fire, and had been unsuccessful. Additionally, without knowing of the propane tank behind the trailer, and with Weir's condition worsening, Madruga, Hewitt, and Sterling may have left to try to locate help, while leaving Mathias to look after Weir. If this was the case, the men had most likely left during the snowstorm on the 28th of February, leading to their demise by hypothermia. A flashlight and 3 blankets were found roughly 1/4 mile from the trailer. It was speculated that Mathias had left to locate his friends and bring them blankets, but may have gotten lost and also died by freezing to death. However, there was no further evidence to support this claim. To further add more to the tower of questions that had formed by this point, the question still lingered. Why were the men on the road to begin with? It was not a connecting road, connecting Chico to Yuba City. None of them had ever traveled the road before, nor would they be familiar with the area. What had driven them to leave the safety of the car and endure the freezing cold in the first place? Why had the men not thoroughly gone through the trailer and located the supplies? These questions will most likely never be met with appropriate answers. One can only speculate based on the information we have before us. However, with every mystery, there lies some details hidden or buried beneath the speculation, begging to be brought to light. In this particular case, something happened that night and over the weeks that followed that will most likely die along that mountain path, following the Yuba County 5 before it. Welcome, campers, to Campfire Tales of the Strange and Unsettling. We're your hosts. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Jordan. And now the debrief. All right, man, I'm hyped about this one. I love mysteries.
I like a good mystery. And this one is very close, as I've stated a couple times now, to our Dyatlov Pass incident, which we both loved. Like, that's such a cool story. Such a crazy one with lots and lots of speculation. I think we're right there with this one as well.
Yeah, I mean it's a mystery. It's as stated, it's, right? Like,
wait, it's a mystery?
It is.
Oh, okay.
Right. Can confirm. No, I don't know. It's just bizarre from the very beginning, right? Because like the part where they like initially diverge from what's expected,
right?
Is that question can't be answered?
No.
Let alone the dozens of questions that follow, right?
Exactly.
Like, you can get into like, well, why did they switch shoes and shit like that? But like, you can't even, there's really no way to even answer why were they there?
Yeah. I mean, there is some speculation on that.
Yeah. Okay.
And some possible reasoning of why they could be there, but no like definitive, like this is why 100% they were going there. Yeah. Right. So.
See, I was only vaguely aware of this story from like, I think a couple years ago I listened to some podcast episode about it.
Okay.
But actually like listening to the story and paying attention and like getting all the details, I'm super excited to hear some of the theories that people have been around.
There's some obvious theories.
Right.
You know, which we'll definitely dive into. But then there's like some really like off the wall kind of things that like how would somebody know this or like what makes someone think that, right?
Right.
So yeah, well, like I said, we'll definitely dive into it for sure.
Excellent. Okay, so getting into it, obviously the biggest difference between this and, you know,
Diet Love Pass.
This is constantly compared to Diet Love Pass, right? It isn't just us. Like,
I mean, it's kind of like America's version or ode to Diet Love Pass, right?
Right. That's how I've always heard it referred to, as like America's Diet Love Pass. But the big difference here is, of course, these people were not outdoorsy. Their families didn't, you know, they like described them as being particularly indoorsy.
Right. And none of them really ever stayed away from home. A lot of them didn't really leave their homes other than to go to this this rec center, or this place where they were, you know, kind of learning trade skills and also getting to play basketball, because they all had a very like fond love for basketball. And that was something that they shared. Right.
I think that's like, that's a huge difference here.
Right.
Is like, I think that's what intrigued me so much initially, is like, at least with the Die Out Love Pass mystery, you know why they're there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's what an established,
their original like plan was. Yeah.
Yeah. And this just, these guys were just supposed to head home.
Yeah.
After the game.
And this is only 2 hours away from their home that they go to Chico and then back to Yuba City. But yet they're found between, like, it's almost, I think it was like almost like 70 miles from each location.
Yeah.
In the middle of this like, mountain. Right. Yeah.
And they drove like, it's like 5,000 feet in elevation up this mountain road.
Something like that. Like, yeah.
Yeah. That's just bizarre.
And which,
I don't know, like, had, do you know if they had gone to games there before?
So in Chico, their favorite team was playing, and I can't remember the exact team. So like, I'm assuming they had been there before. All right, let's just say they had, right? Let's just say they had. But it was also stated that none of them had ever really been in this mountainous area, other than like two of them when they were kids, like their dads would take them hunting.
Yeah.
So like they were familiar with like some trails, but like not like none of them had been on this road or like whatever else, right?
Yeah.
And then you have like Madruga driving his car, like navigating at midnight down these like windy, narrow mountainous roads.
Right.
Also dodging like the snowstorm that's also happening.
And some things are coming back to me. So also, there was like no evidence of damage on the bottom of this car. It was like, which is a huge thing, because you think of like modern cars and it's whatever. They're light, they're like clearance is pretty good.
Yeah.
But like this guy drove, what was it? A 69 Mercury Montego. That's a fucking heavy car.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big car. It's very low to the ground. There's five guys in it. Adult men in the car. And this is where there was a couple like facts that were kind of contradicting. So in most of the reports I read and like most of the videos and podcasts I could listen to all told the same thing. Like they had basically parked the car perfectly parked along the side of the road and had gotten out.
Yeah.
The only leaving the car behind, the only thing about it was they took the keys from the ignition and the window was slightly down.
Okay.
Now there's other things that state like they hit a snowbank. Like there's like a couple of other reports that say they hit a snowbank and they were stuck, but most of the reports they weren't. That was never the case.
Okay.
But one common thing was Madruga's mother said, like he never kept the window down. He never like rolled the window down while driving. Like it was like out. It was very like out of the ordinary for that window to be down in the first place too.
Okay.
So that's a couple minor like little things there. But yeah, like I said, just the fact that like. Some said they parked it, and some said that like they hit a snowbank. But like I said, the majority of it was that they had parked it, which I mean that makes it a lot more confusing though. Like and it bears a lot more questions. Why would they just park it when they had plenty of gas to get back home? And you know, like instead they just park along the side of the road and leave
and just get out.
Right.
Yeah. That's odd. The thing is though, even if they hit a snowbank and got stuck. Again, we're talking about five grown men. You're telling me they can't get a car unstuck?
Right. And that was the argument when it came to that. Like when it came to like, you know, those reports, it was like, why wouldn't they be able to just get it out, push it out? Yeah. Like, you know, between all of them, they were like, you know, stocky guys. They were, you know, taller, like basketball player guys and
athletes. Yeah,
exactly. So which I don't think that holds up very well. So and it just, like I said, it kind of bears to question because when they find the car, it's covered in snow, but it's not like, it's not fully submerged in snow. Like, yeah, it's not fully buried. Right. So which is weird. Like that's one of the first things that struck me. Like, why would you just leave the car when you could easily make it home?
Yeah. See, this is where the theorizing starts already, because what entices five men who rarely break from their routine.
Right.
What entices those five men to get out in the middle of the night during a snowstorm on a mountain road?
Agreed.
It's very strange. Like,
yeah,
it's not normal behavior for anyone, especially for them, because they're so routine driven. Right.
Yeah. And the fact that like they were also playing a big game the next day. Like a game that was getting them into like the Paralympic like finals, right? Like that was like one of the big things. Like, you know, they decided because their favorite team was playing in Chico, they were going to go that night and then come back early enough that they could get plenty of rest and everything before their big game the next day.
Yeah, go get hyped watching their favorite team win and then go home and get ready for their match. Yeah, I don't know. It's That's what I was going to say. There's another big difference between Diet Love and this is obviously the five men who, you know, died or went missing, they're of, you know, reduced mental capacity or had some mental illness.
Yep.
Right. And I feel like a lot of the like coverage on this, from what I remember, a lot of the coverage on this like kind of just kind of groups them together. You know, this is like the 70s also when diagnoses for mental health issues and it wasn't where it is today, right?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, like you have Gary Mathias being grouped in this group because he was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Right.
You know, so like, so he was kind of reduced to that, which I mean, he was kind of like one of the go-getters of the group though. Like,
yeah,
you know, and so, but he had, he had had a couple like mental breaks, like, you know, growing up and stuff that, you know, led to that.
But even that, in the 70s, schizophrenia was still kind of a catch-all diagnosis.
Yeah, that's
for a lot of different mental illnesses.
Right.
Right. So like, and this guy was in war, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He was in West Germany.
Yeah.
And he was honorably discharged because he was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
For all we know, this could be like PTSD. It could be a whole host of mental illnesses that just got umbrellaed under schizophrenia at that time.
Now, they did say like he had been on medicine for the last 5 years after his diagnosis. Yeah. And like during that time, he had done much better. There were reports even by his father saying like he hadn't had any breaks, like, you know, hadn't had even in private, like hadn't had any like, you know, major issues or anything, that like he was a lot more functioning, like, you know, and just was normal. And so, yeah, that's which kind of now, you know,
is this the one that was never found?
That's the one that was never found. Right.
Okay. So obviously I imagine at least one of the theories is that he had another break.
We've got a lot of theories on this one. Yes.
Yeah. Like, because that's definitely a possibility, right? If he was a paranoid schizophrenic, it would be, and he had a mental break, I could definitely see that turning things sideways for the group. This not being a group that would be particularly good at handling a situation like that.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean?
And there was like a running subreddit that was all focused on Gary Mathias and what happened. And a lot of speculation on, like, did he kill the other four?
Right.
You know, and that was the thing. And a lot of people said, like, what if he would have had that mental break? Like, yeah, he hadn't had one in a long time. He'd been taking his meds, whatever. But what if that night something happened? But there's also some other stories, some other facts that were, like, brought about later on.
What if he was, like, trying to stay clear for the big game or whatever and didn't take his med?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I thought about that, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, that's possible. It's definitely possible. Yeah. Now, Madruga, so like I was talking about like how like he left his window, like his driver's side window down and stuff like that. Yeah. His mother believed that basically something had followed them or chased them. She actually stated, quote unquote, "There was some force that made them go up there. They wouldn't have fled into the woods like a bunch of quail. We know good and well that someone made them do it. We can't visualize someone getting the upper hand on those five men, but we know it must have been." So she believes something chased them up there.
Okay.
Which, there are some other things that kind of support that a little bit.
I mean, that is one reason people go places they weren't planning on going.
Exactly.
Right? Is they get chased.
Yeah, and some believe that the men were trying to hide from something. Or someone.
Yeah. Sure.
And so there were rumors that basically foul play had surfaced around the time that the bodies were found. And one person even provided basically details of that night. So this is a little strange. So there was a guy by the name of Joseph Shones.
Okay.
He's driving down the same road that the Mercury Montego was found. So he's driving down this road. And his Volkswagen Beetle, and it had gotten stuck in the snow. And, like, he gets out to try and get it out and suffers a mild heart attack.
Right.
Mild enough that he, like, climbs back in his car and then endures the pain and then goes to sleep.
Just waits it out.
Right. So he ended up spending the night in the car, and he awoke to the sounds of whistles and looked out the window to see several men and a woman holding a baby standing in front of a car off in the distance.
Okay.
He tried to call out for help, but the man and the woman retreated back to their car, lights off, they disappeared.
Hmm.
So he gets back in, goes back to sleep. Sometime later, he's awoken again to lights shining through his windows. And the same sound of a whistle, like that same whistling sound again, right? and but there was nothing there. And a little bit later, his engine died because he had had his car running for so long, just trying to stay warm. The engine died. So he basically got out. He walked about 8 miles down the trail in the freezing cold. Along the way, he finds the Montego sitting on the side of the road. But he didn't think much of it because he had seen like these people off in the distance and like figured like there were some people out here, like maybe they had gotten stuck too, right?
Right.
But yeah, so that was another kind of strange tidbit. So the fact that he like sees these groups, this group of guys along with this woman holding a baby, they do nothing, like they don't help him out or anything. Some people speculate like maybe he didn't actually see a woman, maybe he just saw like the group of guys and they like hear this like person call out for help and get spooked and they like take off and then they get lost.
Sure.
I guess that's possible.
Or the whole thing could have been a cardiac event induced fever dream.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So there is basically I'm trying to go back to it because I know I had more on that. But like one thing is that this Shones guy, he changed his story multiple times. Throughout, like, because, I mean, he was found. Like, you know, he's found, right. He's alive, he's good to go. But he changed his story multiple times. And then he also went back and said that, like, sometimes he would say that he was very ill, and sometimes he would say that he was fine, and that this actually occurred. But sometimes when he'd say he was ill, he would say that he could have hallucinated it.
Yeah.
Due to his well-being at that point, right?
Yeah, I mean, so he goes back and forth basically between he was fine when he woke up, and then sometimes he's saying he was still sometimes feeling terrible when he woke up.
Yeah, and that he could have possibly hallucinated.
Right. I mean, he wouldn't be the first person to have visual and auditory hallucinations during a heart event.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a, you know, some pretty major, even though it was like a minor heart attack. Still, yeah. Like, I mean, that's enough to, it's a heart attack.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you know.
Exactly. A minor heart attack is still a heart attack.
Right. Like, I could definitely see that being the case.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
it is interesting, though. I mean, the five of them were out there. Right?
Exactly.
So he definitely could have seen them.
Now, there is kind of more to this.
Okay.
So some people that were there at the game had seen like this group of guys, and basically that they were had seen them confronted by another group of men.
Okay.
You know, who knows?
Like, right? They saw them having words.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting.
I mean, you know, I could see like, you know, they're, you know, especially like mental capacity, like, you know, health states, sure, and things like that, probably defensive, right?
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I could definitely see that being a thing. But
yeah,
now there's a little bit in 2017, and I didn't want to get there yet, but in 2017, since we're kind of on this path then.
Okay.
So in 2017, Jack Hewitt's sister, supposedly sister-in-law, reached out on a blog. Okay. And I think it was actually on Reddit, you know, so basically, and she had believed that the men had witnessed an altercation between some men and a woman.
Okay.
And this group of five, the Yuba City Five, they tried to help the woman, which then led to a hostile confrontation between the other guys.
Mm.
And as a result, she claimed that Matthias had been thrown off a bridge and had fallen to his death.
Okay.
And that the other men had fled and drove up the mountain trail and got lost in the woods.
Interesting.
Right.
That would kind of tie in with the guy seeing a woman with a group of men.
Exactly. Yes. She could have been part of that group initially. Part of that group. And maybe, like, you know, like, gotten an argument or something, and these guys tried to, like, stick up for her. And then later on, they chase them, you know, chase this group after they, you know, push this guy off of this bridge. they, you know, try and hightail it out, and they chase him into this mountain, like these mountains.
Chase the witnesses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That, I think, is pretty, pretty, like, that's almost compelling, because it would explain why Matthias was never found.
Yep.
You know, and we don't know for sure, like, anything, like, we did see shoes, but, I mean, you know, who's to say 100% those were Matthias's shoes, or... maybe he didn't have his shoes on or something. Maybe they fell off. Who knows?
Maybe he got shoved so hard off the bridge his shoes flew off.
Maybe. Exactly. You know, we don't know. So that was one I thought was a little strange, but it also kind of ties in with what Shones had seen.
Yeah.
With the group of people, the group of men and the woman. Right.
Now, did the sister-in-law say why she thought that was the case?
Not anything I was able to find.
Okay.
Just so that, like, she chimed in, you know, 40 years later.
Yeah.
And was like, hey, you know, like, this is what I believe actually happened. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I mean, maybe she heard some, maybe she was privy to some information that wasn't public. You know what
there
I mean?
There was. So, yeah, there was actually several things that weren't actually published. So another detail that was left out of the police reports was that there were actually shell casings found at the entry to that mountain road.
Okay. So maybe a group in chase was firing shots at their car as they chased them up the mountain road.
Exactly. But they looked and there were no shots or anything on the car. So like there was no hit or anything.
Maybe they're just really bad shots.
Right. Exactly. It's also midnight. In the middle of a snowstorm, like, you know, like, it doesn't take much to be a bad shot then. You know, so that's another one of those things that never made it into any official report, though.
Yeah, that's odd. That seems significant. I don't know why that wouldn't have made it into a police report.
Right. Because that could suggest
violence.
Actual foul play. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of like I find it believable, the idea of them being chased, because, I mean, just it comes back to, why would they drive up that road?
Why would they be there? Exactly. Yeah.
And maybe like, okay, so maybe they're being chased, and maybe the bit about them hitting a drift and getting, you know, temporarily stuck holds up. And the reason they don't take the time to push the car out is because they're being chased.
So they hop out and just jump out of the car. Yeah.
Yeah.
They just start running through the forest. That's possible. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, there's some additional things here. So some believe that the car had actually been moved or dropped off by a third party.
Okay.
And that may have been as a result of a conflict. You know, something had happened. And then basically the bodies are disposed of.
Okay. It just seems like an odd way to dispose of the bodies.
Right. And then also to have one literally sitting and rotting away in a bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, because I know you mentioned that, like, he was nursing some kind of damage. What happened to him? Was it the frostbite that immobilized him?
Yeah, his frostbite. So, yeah, because at that point he had experienced extensive frostbite on his feet.
Gotcha.
Like, enough to where they were gangrenous or whatever.
Right.
Like, you know, and I mean, yeah, like, he couldn't walk.
So he laid in the bed because of that.
Right. And that's why, like, after weeks passed, I mean, there's all this food, there's plenty of things to start a fire. There's
but
literally
he couldn't get up.
A propane tank and heat in this trailer that they could have just turned on by turning on the propane tank. You know, like, yeah. Like, they could have survived if all of them would have stayed there and, like, you know, had their wits about them. They could have survived. Some believe that basically due to their mental state and everything.
Right.
That they didn't quite know how to cope in that situation. But what I don't buy about that is you have two ex-military men, two ex-army men that are part of, they're trained. I mean, that's one of the biggest things that you're taught is how to survive.
Right.
Like in the wild, like if nothing else, you're taught how to survive even minimally, like even someone with like limited brain capacity and things like that would at least have some recollection or some knowledge of that. Right. So that's why I don't buy into that at all.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, like they say, in periods of great stress, you sink to the level of your training. Right.
Right. So, exactly.
Yeah. I don't get that either. So building off of the confrontation with the other group, that theory. And they chase them up the road, they get caught in the snowdrift, they don't have time to push it out, so they jump out of the car, take off into the woods, right? So let's say they walk, it's like 20 miles from the car to the trailer, right?
Yeah, it's literally like 19 point something, literally 20 miles is what it comes down to.
So
from the car to the trailer.
They walk 20 miles through the forest, through the mountains, until they come across this trailer. And probably halfway there, dude's feet are fucked, right?
Right.
So they're probably carrying him at that point.
See, that's what I think, and then they basically get back and throw him onto the bed, like, you know, find the nearest, like, place that they could put him, right?
And then I'm thinking they say, you can't walk, stay here in the bed, we'll go get help, right?
And that's where Hewitt, Madruga, and Sterling all go. And that's why they think, like, maybe they had Gary Mathias stick back with...
Right.
Weir, and you know, as just so someone's there with him.
The only thing that doesn't make sense to me there is Mathias was one of the ex-military guys, right?
Right, exactly. So maybe that was where like they thought like maybe he would figure something out. Like,
wouldn't he at the very least have searched the cabin?
See, fully? That's what's weird about this.
Yeah,
because you would think. And especially because in that same room that Mathias or that Weir is laying in, there's an unlocked cabinet that has a lot of dehydrated food.
Yeah.
Literally enough for a small group to live on for a year. Like that's how much was in there. They would have been perfectly fine if none of them would have left.
What if Mathias never made it to the cabin?
That's possible. Like,
what if at some point he got separated from the group, or he, you know, fell down an embankment, or he, you know, was attacked by an animal or whatever. 100 things that could have happened to him before they ever make it to the trailer. Then they get to the trailer. I think they leave Weir there alone. I think maybe they like drag over a pile of whatever the first food they see, and they're like, you stay here, we'll go get help. The rest of them go, leave him there, and he literally can't get up out of the bed because his feet are so messed up. So once he goes through that food that they dragged over to him,
that's all he has.
He basically lays in the bed and starves.
But if it were me, even though, my feet are jacked, I'd be like crawling or like, you know, something, looking for some way to like stay alive. Like,
maybe he was in like
stay in the bed the whole time.
I wonder how long you can stay in like a semi hypothermic state and stay alive. Because I bet it's a while.
I'm sure it's a while.
Maybe he could have been delirious for half of the time he was there. You know.
Yeah, I suppose that's possible. Like
not even realizing that he was starving to death.
Because it's also said that he ends up losing basically 80 pounds.
Yeah. So he's there for weeks.
Yeah. Man, that's insane. That's a lot of weight. Like,
yeah,
to lose. I mean, with your body literally eating away at itself.
To lose almost half of your body weight.
Right. Now, but what about like, and that's the other question where I get back to like, Mathias's shoes are there, and Weir's shoes are gone.
Yeah, that's pretty odd.
So, but maybe they changed out shoes in the middle of the day, or night, or something.
That's
possible, right?
If he had the frostbite, right? So
we're, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe, sorry, I'm kind of having trouble keeping everyone's name straight, but.
Right. Yeah. No, I understand for sure. There's five of them. So it's kind of.
Yeah. Maybe halfway there or part of the way there, Weir is like complaining about his feet, right? Freezing. He's wearing these like cloth shoes or whatever they are.
Well, Weir had leather shoes, and it was said that Matthias had more of, I think he had like more of like tennis shoes or something like that.
And they switched? So the guy with frostbite took the tennis shoes? See,
I don't know. That's the only way I could think that, like, because he's in leather shoes, I would feel like his feet would have survived a lot longer than.
Maybe that's why he got the frostbite, because he switched shoes.
That's what I'm saying. Like, maybe they switched off earlier on or something. Maybe like his feet were hurting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then Matthias is like, yeah, you know, we're the same size. I'll swap. Like, that's fine.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, who I'll knows? Take those fucking leather shoes.
Right. Exactly.
I don't
like,
know.
That's the only reason I could think, like, otherwise, how would he have developed frostbite so quickly?
Yeah.
When no one else did.
Yeah, that is pretty odd. Yeah, I mean, it could have come down to he just had the worst shoes. You know?
Right, exactly.
I mean, there are a lot of details, right? Maybe his shoes were, like, old and shitty. Maybe, like, he had holes in the soles of his shoes. And you know what I mean? Like, could have been a bunch of things. I mean, it's hard to tell in the 70s. I associate, like, basketball people with being pretty obsessed with their shoes.
Right.
So,
I mean, back then, it was shitty sneakers shoes, of pretty much any kind, right?
Right.
You know, so, yeah, maybe he had some, like, just canvas sneakers that we all know are awful in the snow.
Yes.
And
anyone who grew up listening to punk rock knows the torture of wearing Chuck Taylors in January. Right,
exactly.
Yeah.
Literally one step and your foot is soaked and freezing. Yep.
For the whole day. And you have to sit through school all day with frozen, fucking sopping wet feet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a good way to go.
I know those days, that's for sure. But yeah, that's like the only reason, like only logical reason I could put together why.
Yeah. But he'd get the frostbite.
Like, right, exactly. So, because I know he also didn't have a coat. Neither him or Matthias had coats.
It's incredible that they lasted at all walking 20 miles in those weather conditions without even a coat.
Yeah, exactly.
That's insane.
So, like, there's just a lot that doesn't add up to me.
Yeah.
Now, there's also, so it's said that, so Gary Matthias, the one that hasn't ever been found.
Right.
He had a friend that lived in Forbestown. So Forbestown is basically between Chico and Yuba City and this mountainy area.
Okay. It's in the vicinity of where all this happened?
Right. It's not super close, but it's in that direction. Like, if they would have turned off on this road, they would have turned off on another road. They would have went to Forbestown. Instead, they went off on this other road. Right.
Okay. So maybe they were going to see that friend.
Right. So some people think that, like, maybe Matthias, like, talked them into, like, going there. Like, it was snowing so bad that, like, it was the closest place to go. And then basically they missed their turn to Forbestown, and then they get lost in this just in the mountains.
Okay.
You know, they make the wrong turn and then boom, it's, you know, now it's just dealing with all of that.
Right.
So I guess that's another thing. So, like, yeah, it's said that he knew somebody that lived kind of out in that direction.
Well, if you remove the element of them being chased, then the next big question is why would they leave their car? Like, there's literally no good reason to leave a car that still has gas in it. Yeah.
Exactly. Or even if just to sit in it and be warm, like,
yeah, like the heart attack guy did.
Exactly. It just, that does not make any sense.
And why would they continue walking in the direction that instead of going back the way they came? You know what
back
I mean?
Towards like a main highway.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's just stuff that just doesn't add up. I know.
Yeah, it's odd.
Now, Of course, there are some that think alien abduction.
Right, right. I was hoping this was about to get fun.
Yeah. So there are some that think, you know, like, Matthias was abducted by aliens. The others, like, tried to fight it off or whatever else, and then they all end up dead. You know,
or just fled.
Exactly.
Because of the experience.
The other thing is some think it was a Yeti.
Right.
And, you know, like, so, but you can't go anywhere without those being possibilities.
Dude, a Northern California Bigfoot? Yeah. Just wrecking them? Yeah, I could see that. I could see something like that happening. Like, maybe they go to visit the guy, they miss the turn, maybe they do make the decision we would make and go, like, we're just gonna camp out in the car. When the sun comes up, we'll figure out which way we need to go and go that way.
Yeah.
And problem is, halfway through the night, they get a damn Bigfoot knocking on the door.
Hey, I mean, that's possible. That's definitely possible.
Yeah.
Or, our Sean's friend had seen, like, as he was sitting there, he saw those bright lights.
Yeah.
Throughout his car windows and never saw what it was. He only heard that whistling sound.
UFO.
And then it was gone. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting.
So that's a possibility. I mean, there's not really anything that goes into it because you can't really speculate how or what happened. Like, you know,
sure.
Just that, like, it could have been that.
There's no like landing site or
right. Corroborating. There was nothing that they were able to find that like would have like matched that being a thing.
Okay. I mean, you could say that the sighting by the fellow that had the heart attack, you could consider that like corroborating witness statement, right? Of like the mysterious lights, the odd whistling.
The people that he saw that just retreated. Like maybe they weren't humans.
Yeah. Maybe he thought some were male and some were female because they were both neither.
Oh man. So yeah, that's another one. You know, just like I said, it's hard not to like at least go that direction. Now, like I mean, just the fact that Matthias was never found. So this is what so a lot of people speculate on this, right? He was never found. Some people believe like he didn't make it long at all.
Okay.
Some people believe that he also made it significantly further, and like there, I forget, there's this other town that's like, or this other area, smaller area, further into the mountains, that he died in between that, like the trailer in there, and I can't remember exactly where it's called, but like,
okay,
that like the area was never thoroughly investigated enough, but like they looked at this area a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, they went pretty in depth.
Well, they had the detective that was like obsessed with the case, right?
Right. Yeah, Lieutenant Ayers. So, like, you know, like I would feel they would find something because they extended their search. They extended their search like miles. And I mean, like, think of like, I mean, maybe he managed to stay alive. Maybe he managed to like whatever for a couple of days. But like, in that, like, you're only going to get so far and. Such like treacherous conditions.
Yeah.
And the fact that he probably didn't, and maybe he found that food in the trailer and he took a bunch of the dehydrated food with him.
Could be.
Maybe he like took a box of matches and found like was able to start a fire. Maybe he made it to his friend's house. But he's never been seen again. This is the thing. His remains have never been found.
It's odd. It's definitely really odd.
Exactly.
It has to be realized here also that the Sierra Nevada mountain range is massive.
Oh, it's huge.
I mean, we're talking like massive tracts of unpopulated wilderness.
Like we've even talked about this when it came to like Lake Tahoe and stuff like that. Like that mountain range is massive.
Yeah. So like this isn't just like a small rural stretch between towns. You know what I mean? Like this is miles and miles and miles of wilderness.
Yeah.
That I mean, like you said, maybe he made it way longer than they did. But the question would be, how would he not figure out which way to go?
See, I don't know. Like, because you go and, I mean, it's, there's that thing, like, right, you go so long in one direction. If you get turned around, you don't know which direction you're really going in anymore.
Yeah.
Especially if the area all looks the same.
Right.
It would be so easy to get off path. Unless, yep, like, you literally, I mean, like, nowadays, like, we have phones, like, we have built-in compasses everywhere.
Yeah.
Or GPS, like, you know, it's hard to get lost now.
Harder
to get lost than it used to be. Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, like, yeah, if they would have been prepared, like, you know, they would have been prepared for just in case, which, you know, I mean, I know that they probably hadn't planned on driving into these mountains anyways.
Yeah,
because it was all like a stretch of highway that they took to get to Chico and back. Like, that's all they needed.
And let's not get lost in the fact that Matthias was a military guy, because even his family made like special note to say that he was not outdoorsy.
Right.
He was in the military, but that doesn't mean that he knows his way around the woods very well.
Right.
You know what I mean?
He might not know his way around the woods, but I think he at least would have some common sense on survival.
He would have survival skills for sure.
Right.
But like, yeah. I don't, anyone can get lost. If watching years and years of Les Stroud has taught me anything, it's that like getting lost in the forest happens to super advanced,
even the best of people,
outdoor. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like maybe he did, maybe he, you know, maybe the rest of the group went down from cause after cause, right? Whatever they may be. And he was just the last one and grabbed up some dehydrated meals and some matches and struck out on his own. And
yeah,
see, just made it so deep in. Maybe he just made it so deep into the mountains that they never found him.
Exactly. Right? Yep. And then after, you know, like your body's there, like, yeah, like there's bears, there's everything else there. Like, I mean, we know, like, even one of the guys, Jack Hewitt, the only thing really found was, from him, was his skull and his backbone.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Along with, like, his jeans and, you know, whatever.
And his father found him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which would be...
My God.
That'd be tough. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, I mean, those being, like, the only two things found, and the only way that they could really identify him was by his dental records.
Right. And that's just assumed that that was from predation.
Backbone and a skull. Like, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's intense. I mean, this is like legit wilderness.
Right. Yeah.
So
exactly. And this is northern California, where that's, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, you're into like Tahoe area and all of that. It's like expansive.
Yeah.
Like forest.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. It's super crazy, and it's, like I said, it's hard to really like go one direction, because like there's the what ifs, or but that doesn't really add up. Like, right, then why not, you know? So
yeah, I feel like
that's where
this
reminds me a lot of Dyatlov Pass. Like,
yeah, you know? I mean, there is no good answer here.
And then there's still that question of, just like the subreddit, did Matthias kill the other four?
Right.
And this has been something people have talked about for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
Did he end up having a break? Did he like kill them and then drive back himself?
Right.
Try and get rid of the bodies or make it look like something, you know, he didn't. Like, did it happen naturally?
Yeah, but carrying them 20 miles into the woods.
I mean, yeah, I know.
That's
or
pretty...
maybe they all got to the cabin and
maybe that's when the break happened. The stress of being lost and being out there, maybe that caused the break.
Or he went after Hewitt, you know, Madruga and Sterling, and killed all them out in the woods, and left Weird die off.
Yeah,
like, yeah. So, I mean, we know he was alive for several weeks.
Yeah,
we know that he lasted several weeks. So that's one 100% thing we know.
Man, that's
he lasted
so,
at least a couple weeks.
That's so horrifying.
Yeah, that would be awful.
Ugh.
Like not being able to do anything, like
literally
not even leaving the bed, which, like I said, if it were me, I would find some way to figure it out, like, you know, just endure the pain, like your feet are already gone, just go with it.
That's what I'm saying. At a certain level of like pain and cold, there's no way he was all there, you know.
Oh, I agree.
But I don't know. I feel like the gap between running out of food and getting to that point, there had to be a gap there where most people would have dragged themselves to the food.
The problem with that is also we're being the oldest one of the group. He also had the mind of a child.
Right.
He had the brain capacity of a child. So, like, literally, you know, I mean, that could also be it. Like, you know, like you have,
it's like a little boy.
I'm assuming a child's survival instincts are going to be significantly less of that of, an adult.
Yeah. Their ability to handle the situation certainly would be.
Right.
And like the resolve, right, that it would take to drag your badly frostbitten feet even across
through
the floor.
The pain to like just endure it and like just for survival instinct. Like, you know, I could see that being a lot less, you know, in somebody in that, that capacity.
Yeah, so that's a fair
point.
That
could explain it. Right.
Yeah.
It's just, it's hard to really formulate any real theory or like, you know, I do think that Matthias probably made it longer. I personally don't think he killed everybody. Like, I mean, you know, I don't know, but you know, I'm just gonna say, you know, like I doubt it at least.
I mean, this is another case where the only way to talk about it really is to write a screenplay, right? Because there's so little evidence that makes sense.
Right.
That like you have to kind of fill in the blanks with fantasy, you know?
Yeah, you're right. You're right, for sure.
And I enjoy that. I do like a lot.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing. It's not, I like those, you know.
Yeah, it's like getting a really weird writing prompt.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's just such a weird, weird situation.
Yeah.
But that's why it is so, like, such a big thing. That's why people refer to it as the American version of the Dyatlov Pass incident.
Because I mean, this mystery has endured half a century.
Exactly.
You know, that's,
yep,
that's significant. Yeah, it's right up there with Dyatlov and the lighthouse and
That one, like, too. Right.
Yeah. These just stories where
personally think? I mean, do you have any idea, any opinions at all?
Honestly, I lean toward them being chased onto the mountain.
Okay.
That something happened, some kind of confrontation with another group. I don't know if it was
the group that
was supposedly seeing them arguing with at the game. That seems odd to me that it would, you know, that the confrontation would boil over so far away.
Right. But it's the 70s, and think of like people messing with like these people that may be a little bit slower. May not be like, you know, all there versus like, yeah, I mean, I could see some, you know, idiot out there just be like, oh yeah, you know, whatever. Right. And then like they mess with them so much that like these people get in their car to take off and these people chase after them.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so yeah. I could definitely see that being at least what kind of drove them to get there.
Yeah. One of those like asshole fueled horror stories.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But normally, like, those guys also get the, you know, bad end of it, too, because they end up on the wrong road and, you know, next to some pretty gnarly territory.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. I like the idea of them being chased onto the mountain. That makes the most sense to me, that they would divert that strongly. I think that makes more sense than like, oh, they missed a turn and just kept going for some reason.
I think so too.
You know?
Yeah. For sure.
Cause these are mountain roads, but to my understanding, they're not like single lane, like dirt, right?
As far as we know. Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is a road you could ostensibly turn your car around on.
I would think so.
Yeah. Because they pulled to the side of the road. That's the way it was worded, right?
Yep. Yeah, they pulled off to the side of the road, like, next to, like, this bank.
If you can pull off the road, then you can turn the car around. I don't know, man. I think probably chased onto the mountain, jumped out to try to get away when they got stuck, and I think things probably just devolved from there.
Yeah.
They just, maybe they traded shoes and the bad shoes led to bad frostbite. And then I think probably they left. Okay, this is the way I see it. They left Weir in the cabin because he couldn't walk anymore.
Yeah.
And maybe they were, you know, exhausted from carrying him. It was just like a, we'll get to help faster if you stay here and we'll yeah. come back for you. Right. And then they go down one by one until only Matthias is left. And Matthias just keeps going.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get turned around once or twice in the woods and all of a sudden you think you're going the right way and you're not. And you do that for a week. And what the hell do you do at that point once you're a week in the wrong direction?
Exactly. And with nowhere, no yeah. way to get back, like...
You run out of matches, you run out of food, and right. you're a week off track.
Civilization's not close, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed.
That makes the most sense to me.
Yeah, I think I'm right there, too. That just is the only thing that could really provide any rational explanation, I think.
I mean, either that, or the full car was tractor-beamed by mantids. And...
Maybe.
And one of them were kept and, you know, the rest of them were chopped up and sprinkled into the woods.
Thrown out throughout the... And, right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then, you know, the aliens just dropped the car perfectly on the side of the road on some random mountain.
I mean, if we're being honest, that's the coolest option.
That, yeah. I don't know. That midnight... Bigfoot attack is pretty gnarly story too.
Yeah, that could be. Oh.
But no damage to the car.
And right.
I buy that less. I'm saying probably that first story is the most likely, and the mantid attack is the coolest.
I'll agree with that. I think the first option, like I said, I think we're right there thinking the same thing. Second, obviously, anytime aliens are involved, some abduction of some kind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll always lean in that direction as a... Maybe that's a possible.
Yeah. And for the listeners out there, I just chose mantids because I was trying to think of a race that would, like, chop up people like a blender.
Yeah.
You know?
There you go.
Yeah. That might only leave a spine and skull behind.
They are pretty gnarly.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I think we're together in that, and so...
Yeah.
I think that should wrap it up. That's episode 36, the Yuba County 5.
Thank you. From the bottom of our weird, possibly alien, maybe ghostly, probably cryptid hearts for listening. We absolutely love having the chance to discuss all these wild creatures and events every week, and it's your continued attention that allows us to carry on.
We want to get to know each and every one of you, so please come and check us out on all the socials. At campfire.tales.podcast on Instagram and Facebook. At campfire.totsau on Twitter. And you can also visit our website at campfirepodcastnetwork.com. If you love the show, please rate and review it. It's what truly helps us continue bringing your weekly dose of the strange and unsettling.
And a special thanks to Greg Martin at Reverent Music on Instagram for his contributions to the beautiful music that you hear every week under the debrief. You can find more of his tunes at reverbnation.com/reverent. It's fantastic, fantastic stuff. Go give that a listen.
And that's it. Until next time.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Jordan.
And remember, campers,
stay weird.
And trust in the unknown.